I'm going to call this meeting of the Government Operations Committee to order. The first item, okay, everyone could take it down here, that would be appreciated. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes for the February 25th meeting. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the approval of the minutes of February 25th.
Okay, Representative Elkins moves the minutes. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Minutes are approved. I think we're going to start with Representative Morrison, House File 3228. One second, and this is going to the Judiciary Committee. So welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 3228 be recommended to pass and move to the Judiciary Committee. You have an amendment, it looks like, as well. Did you want to move that now to put it in the shape you would like it?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I will move the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. The bill is in the shape you would like. Representative Morrison, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 3228 would establish a prescription drug affordability commission to give the state the ability to limit how much residents pay for certain high-cost drugs. All of us will need a medication at some point in our lives. Some of us need medication every day. We are all aware that the price of prescription drugs has accelerated in a way that has put some life-saving medications out of reach for some Minnesotans. As a physician, I encounter this in my practice every day. The tragic case of Alex Smith losing his life because he was forced to ration the insulin he needed to live shocked most of us. Many Minnesotans are struggling to afford the medicine that they need. Others are afraid that becoming sick will leave them bankrupt. Just a few recent examples of the many that exist about skyrocketing drug prices. The cost of Bavencio, a new cancer drug approved several years ago, is about $156,000 a year per patient. A new muscular dystrophy drug came on the market for an eye-popping price of $300,000 annually. In 2016, the FDA approved a new bladder cancer treatment that costs $12,500 a month, or $150,000 a year. Even older drugs that have been on the market are not immune. The cost of insulin tripled between 2002 and 2013, despite no notable changes in the formulation. And the four-decade-old EpiPen, a life-saving medication, has seen a price hike of 500% since 2007. The out-of-control cost of prescription drugs has reached a point that action is required. The state has the legal authority and, frankly, the responsibility to take action to address this problem. Our bipartisan, in both the House and Senate, Prescription Drug Affordability Commission is one way to do just that. The legislation is based on a National Academy of State policy model. Maryland and Maine have both passed into law and established prescription drug affordability boards. It is also the top recommendation of the Attorney General's task force on lowering pharmaceutical drug prices. The commission would give Minnesota the ability to limit how much residents and state-regulated entities pay for certain high-cost drugs that present an affordability challenge to the state health system or patients. The commission would examine the cost that a drug would impose on the healthcare system and patients and set a maximum reimbursement level, also known as an upper payment limit, that applies throughout Minnesota's healthcare system, from distributors to doctors, pharmacies, hospitals, insurers, and consumers. The commission will be comprised of seven positions, three appointed by the governor and one each from the majority and minority leads of the House and Senate. The members must have demonstrated expertise in healthcare economics and be free of certain conflicts of interest. The commission will be advised by an 11-member stakeholder affordability council appointed by the governor based on expertise in areas including pharmaceutical business, medical practice, patient perspective, and healthcare marketplace. The commission will have the authority to review the affordability of drugs that meet certain cost thresholds detailed in the bill, such as for brand name drugs and biologics, an increase in the wholesale acquisition cost of 10% or $10,000 during any 12-month period, or an introductory wholesale acquisition cost of more than $30,000 per year, or course of treatment for generics, an increased wholesale acquisition price of 200% or more. When a drug meets these thresholds, the manufacturer must report to the commission. The manufacturers, as well as the other entities such as insurers and pharmacies, will have the opportunity to provide information explaining their prices. The commission is also required to consider public input and may rely on the advisory council for additional context and advice. Once the commission has decided to conduct a cost review of a specific drug, it may consider factors enumerated in the bill, including price, the impact on patients, drug-specific patient access programs, therapeutic alternatives, public comment, and more. If the commission finds that the reviewed drug creates an affordability challenge, it must consider the cost of administering and delivering the drug and other relevant costs when setting the maximum reimbursement level. This commission is based on two long-standing precedents. One, public service commissions exist in all 50 states, setting rates for vital services such as electric, natural gas, taxi, and telecommunication services, especially when there's little or no market competition. Likewise, the Prescription Drug Affordability Commission will work to maintain or increase access to vital services and products. The legislation recognizes that prescription drugs are a public good and are universally needed, and that these critical drugs often have only a few suppliers. Second, the decades-old practice in healthcare of not paying charges for products and services, but rather setting payment limits or allowed amounts, which may be unrelated to list price. The concept of limiting payments is ubiquitous in both state and local government health financing programs, as well as in commercial health insurance programs. Currently, individual payers negotiate these payment or reimbursement limits with suppliers such as provider groups, drug manufacturers, et cetera, resulting in a patchwork of prices and availability for patients. In the prescription drug space in particular, layers of complexity in the supply chain, lack of competition, and lack of regulation have evaded market forces and allowed for continuously skyrocketing prices. The commission would band together the influence of payers across the state to set reasonable maximum reimbursement levels for prescription drugs sold in Minnesota. Thank you. Yep.
Thank you, Dr. Morrison. I do have four people who have signed up to testify on this bill. Please try to keep your testimony within the 2 to 3 minute range. There are several people who are here for a bill later on the agenda, and I want to be respectful of their time. So, I guess it's only three people. One just got crossed out. So the first I have, and you can both come down if you, actually you could all come down if you want at the same time, just to save time. I have Will Phillips, Claire Henn, and Christine Jalofsky. You're welcome to pull chairs up from the table that aren't being used. Whichever order you would like, just please make sure you identify yourself first for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Okay, good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Will Phillips. I'm the state director of AARP Minnesota. And with more than 650,000 members here in our state, AARP appreciates the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3228, which establishes the Prescription Drug Affordability Commission to ensure that drug prices are reasonable, justified, and support consumer access and affordability. Prescription drugs are a high priority for AARP. Our members are 50 years of age and older, and many of them, just like everybody else, struggle every day to afford needed and life-saving medications. We know high drug costs hurt everyone, not only those who rely on prescription drugs for their health and their chronic conditions, but all of us who are paying higher premiums, out-of-pocket costs for health insurance, as well as the taxpayers who help fund our public programs. Americans have continued to see their prescription drug prices skyrocket, and there is nothing that stops drug companies from charging the highest price the market will bear. About 30 years ago, the public was outraged over a drug that cost less than $10,000 per year. We now have drugs approaching $1 million per year, and a recent study noted that the average annual retail cost of prescription drug therapy for a specialty drug is nearly $79,000 per year. Now that's a number that is above the US median household income and more than three times the median income for Medicare beneficiaries. For years, AARP research has shown drug prices are rising faster than inflation, and they're quickly out of reach for many of our members. And moreover, older Minnesotans tend to take more drugs on average, typically 2 to 4 prescriptions to manage chronic conditions. So any increase can make the cost of these drugs unaffordable. It's hardly surprising then that our members consistently tell us that this is one of their top issues of concern and that they can't afford the medications they need. Take, for example, the story of Sue and Tom Counters from La Crescent. Sue Counters has breast cancer and a prescription costing more than $240,000 a year. Now, they feel lucky because they have insurance, but even with insurance, their cost is $12,000 a year, and they worry without Social Security and a pension that they wouldn't be able to afford even that. You'll also hear later from another storyteller sitting to my left, Claire Henn, whose story illustrates the difficult trade-offs people have to make when they can't afford their medications. So we hear these stories every day. People are facing serious health and financial consequences, and the reality of many of these stories is that we're often talking about costs that patients will face every year for the rest of their lives. So on behalf of them and countless others, it's time for Minnesota to take action to rein in the high cost of prescription drugs. House File 3228 will allow the Affordability Commission, an independent body, to evaluate and set maximum upper payment limits for prescriptions to protect consumers, to protect state and local governments, and other healthcare stakeholders that create affordability challenges and thus limit patient access. The bill recognizes, again, that medications are a public good and universally needed. Bills such as this and others introduced this session could save all of us money, patients, taxpayers, and our overall healthcare system. But more importantly, and the bottom line for AARP, is that they can help ensure that all Minnesotans have affordable access to the drugs they need to get and stay healthy. Thanks again for the opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony. Could the next testifier please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony?
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Claire Henn, and I'm here because my life has been impacted by the high cost of prescription drugs. A number of years ago, I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, and after bad side effects from many drugs, was put on Remicade, a drug that reduces inflammation and pain and can slow down the progression of the disease. At that time, my copay was $60 a treatment. And my disease was well managed on the Remicade at that time. Then the cost of the drug skyrocketed to my copay of $1,400 a treatment, and I couldn't pay that. And it's really severely impacted my life. I made the tough decision, because there were no other drugs I could take at that time, to go off Remicade, because I couldn't pay for it. And I used turmeric and Aleve for 3 years. I was without treatment until my doctor found a charity that would help pay for my copays. During that time, my body reached a point where it was difficult to even use a knife and fork. During the years I went without Remicade, my rheumatoid arthritis advanced and caused irreparable damage. And as a result, when I went back on the Remicade, it caused dangerous side effects. I'm now on Orencia. My copay is $1,070 every 4 weeks. I'm only able to be on it because I received the assistance of a charitable organization. If that charity runs out, I'm back in the same position, unable to afford medication, and I can't go in the donut hole because it's not an option because I can't pay the bills I would run up in order to get there. Without this assistance, I will be forced out of my home to pay for my medication. I always believed that I should have the right to age gracefully in my and with dignity, but the high cost of prescription drugs almost robbed me of that ability. Nobody should be forced to make that kind of a harsh trade-off that is all too common now, sacrificing one's health and quality of life in order to keep your home. It's time for Minnesota to take action on this year to rein in the high cost of prescription drugs. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Christine Jalowski. I'm the Senior Director of Pharmacy at Hennepin Healthcare. And thank you, Chair Freiberg and members of the committee for allowing me to testify today. We see daily the impact and challenges that high drug prices have on patients and on the healthcare system. And I speak in support of establishing the Prescription Drug Authority Commission to improve access to medications and improve access to healthcare. Hennepin Healthcare is an integrated system of care that includes a nationally recognized level one adult and pediatric trauma center, an acute care hospital, as well as a clinic system with primary clinics located throughout Hennepin County. We are one of the largest disproportionate share hospitals in the country. We treat a large number of Medicaid and uninsured individuals. And our goal is to partner with our community, with our patients and our families to ensure exceptional care without exception. And sometimes this is difficult. Patients don't understand what medical and prescription coverage is available to them, and that's where we come in. My pharmacy staff works to get drugs covered, which ensures access to prescribed care. It's our job to work for our patients, to advocate on their behalf to insurance companies, especially as the cost of prescription drugs continue to skyrocket. And being said that, almost no one is actually paying those high list prices. But the system for figuring out who pays what is not consistent, it's complicated, and it's extremely costly. When a patient cannot afford a medication, it's often one of these high-cost drugs. A request is then sent to our pharmacy prior authorization team, who will look for lower-cost alternatives. We may submit a copay or tier-lowering exception request to the insurance company, seek a secondary insurance coverage, or look at copay cards. The prior authorization process is cumbersome. And for every copay or tier exception request submitted to an insurance company, there are additional prior authorization steps to be completed. If the prior authorization team is unable to help lower the cost or find a lower cost alternative, then the request may go to our patient assistance program team, where we look for manufacturer or copay assistance programs and grants for our patients. Transitioning a case from our prior auth team to patient assistance team does take additional time for our staff and obviously for the patient. And in these cases, we often need additional information from providers and payers to complete the transaction. The last option available for our patients is to refer them to a Hennepin Healthcare financial counselor. And there we may apply for secondary state assistance or refer them to the state Social Security office or an insurance plan to see if they meet income limits for additional assistance. This is a burdensome process. It's burdensome for our patients, providers, and our staff. In 2019, the prior authorization team handled more than 12,000 requests. 13% of these were denied. That means 13% of our cases that we handled, despite our efforts, could not find an affordable option for the patient. The providers, the pharmacists and the patients then need to reevaluate the course of treatment. And this can take anywhere from a day to 2 weeks to go through the process. And that's a long time for a patient to know that they're not receiving the treatment that was prescribed to help them. The Prescription Drug Affordability Act would establish the Oversight Commission to evaluate drug prices and set the maximum reimbursement levels, setting a limit on how much patients in Minnesota need to pay. It represents a better way to organize what is charged and to look at patient costs in Minnesota and what we're paying. And this will achieve overall lower costs for our patients and the state. Hennepin Healthcare welcomes the opportunity to be a resource for the commission on this issue. And we thank the committee for the opportunity to have input today.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, welcome to the committee. Please come forward, identify yourself for the tape, and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Freiberg and members of the committee, my name is Erin Hears McArdle. My husband and I live in Anoka with our first grade son. I'm a fine art jeweler and metalsmith working out of my home studio and also am a member of the Anoka Hennepin School Board. I'm sharing my story today to do my part in stopping unethical drug pricing. Over 20 years ago, I was diagnosed with what is now called type 1 narcolepsy. There's only one medication, Xyrem, that comes close to keeping my symptoms under control. In 2007, the retail price of Xyrem, a liquid oral medication, was $2.04 a milliliter. In 2014, it was $19.40 a milliliter. Today, it's $29.69 a milliliter. At my dose, a 180 milliliter bottle lasts 10 days, bringing the annual retail price to $192,400.56. I'm fortunate to have prescription coverage that covers all but $35 a month of that cost, but that just makes me one of the lucky ones. There's no reason that Jazz Pharmaceuticals should be allowed to price gouge Xyrem. As a treatment for a rare disease, this medicine was developed with our tax dollars through publicly funded research grants from the Food and Drug Administration, administered through the Office for Orphan Medical Products. There's no research and development debt to justify these egregious price increases. Medicine is a public good, but while Big Pharma spends money on lobbying and advertising, the public is paying for medicine twice, once through publicly funded research, and again at the pharmacy. In the Netherlands and in many other countries where drug pricing is regulated, the annual retail price of Xyrem is less than a one-month supply of the medicine in the United States, but it's the same medicine. This greed is unconscionable. Before I had access to Xyrem, I couldn't drive. I couldn't walk 100 yards without falling down from cataplexy. I couldn't take care of myself, and I had no idea how the rest of my life would go. Xyrem has given me back my life. Too many people with debilitating narcolepsy can't afford Xyrem. Too many insurance companies refuse to cover Xyrem's high cost. So many people who need medications are suffering because corporations are price gouging the medicines we need to live. Drugs don't help if people can't afford them. We need our elected officials to change the rules. Please support House File 3228. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Is there any questions? Representative Tice?
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Morrison, for bringing this forward, because I think we need to have a discussion about and continue to have discussions about the cost of drugs. I'm a type 2 diabetic, and so I'm using quite a few prescriptions, and they do change, I don't want to say quite a bit, but often enough, due to my PBM or new drugs coming on the market that make dealing with it a little bit easier every day. But I have a little bit of, I have several concerns about some of the things that I'm seeing here or not seeing. The first one is, are there no prescription drug experts going to be on the commission unless they're appointed by the governor?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, there are specifically enumerated that there will be pharmaceutical experts on the advisory council. And people who are appointed to the commission are deemed to have expertise in healthcare economics.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but we're really not sure what that means, correct?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's self-explanatory that there would
okay.
be expertise.
Representative Tice.
Okay. One of the things that does bother me is that I know that the mandates and regulations and such do add to the cost of products. So putting a program like this in place does concern me about what it means to our state. Are we going to see innovation come to us? Are we going to see folks innovating in Minnesota, knowing that whatever product they come up with is going to be regulated or priced according to what we believe the price should be? I do know that when we look at, what I want to know is, are we looking at the part that government plays in the cost of drugs, and how is that going to work with having a commission that sets prices?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, This does not set prices, I guess, first of all. This sets a maximum reimbursement level. And the other thing that's important to remember is this: the commission would not review every single drug. This would just review drugs that present an affordability challenge to patients and to the healthcare system. So hopefully it would be a limited number of drugs.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Morrison. But I guess I'm afraid that since the commission's meeting, it shall meet every 3 months. If it's a drug that I might need or my mom might need, she has rheumatoid and osteoarthritis and goes to the doc more than I do for a lot of these things. I guess I'm just concerned that when we have some new innovative drugs, that it's going to take a while for us to be able to get a hold of them. And I guess I would say one of the biggest helps to me was not having to prick my fingers every day and only having to put a device on once a week or once every 10 days. I'm just afraid that we will disrupt that flow of medicines to the public if it has to go through this process. Could you help me understand, will drugs have to wait until it goes through the commission, or will we be able to have access beforehand?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I think that first of all, again, it's only medicines that provide an affordability challenge, mm-hmm. and drugs don't work if they're not accessible to patients, if they're not affordable. So that would limit access. That does limit access now for a lot of people. And in terms of innovation, the pharmaceutical industry is one of the most profitable industries. And even a study was done in 2019 that I thought was interesting. It found that the industry could face an 11% profit reduction and still have the most return on capital investment of any other industry. And even a 21% reduction in profit would leave the industry still more competitive than 75% of other industries. So I think it's a stretch to say that the few drugs that would be triggered to be examined by the commission would stifle innovation.
Yeah. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Morrison. I hope you're right, because I've been in an industry where there is a lot of regulation and all that, and it does stifle growth. So I hope you're right, but I really am not on board with this at this time. But I really do appreciate the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrison, how is a consensus defined? I don't see any. Maybe I'm missing it. Is there a definition of what? Is it just a simple majority of the panel?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I believe the commission will make those rules for themselves. I would imagine it's a simple majority, but they'll have to work through that.
Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrison, I am pleased to hear that this is not an attempt for government to set price controls on a private industry. Can you give me some more reassurance that that's in fact not what this bill does or is attempting to provide a stepping stone to do such a thing?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I think that is important to understand that it does not set prices. It sets a maximum reimbursement limit, again, just for medicines that create an affordability challenge. The pharmaceutical companies are still free to price drugs as they like, but this is just a small subset of medications. This is not all medications that come on the market.
Okay. Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Morrison. Mm-hmm.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Morrison. First of all, of course, thank you for bringing this legislation forward. I think you know that I am not only a co-author on this bill, but a strong supporter, so thank you for that. The one question that I had, and I know we're talking about reimbursement rates rather than direct pricing, but I know that there are models specifically that deal more directly with pricing and that in places like Germany, but I'm curious if this might be part of the consideration for that panel as well. And one of the things that they do in looking at new drugs coming on the market And of course, this is, again, to be clear, a small subset of those who present affordability challenges. But when they do look at how those things are priced, one of the things that they do is they evaluate if that potential, if it's something that's new to the market, if it's something that provides sort of a game changer, if you will, in the marketplace, so that they can account for whether or not something might need a larger amount of reimbursement, at least initially, to recover some of those R&D costs. But then, of course, they often work with the individual companies to then set a motion, a path, so that as time goes on, those they would work to reduce that overall price as they get back their investment and make it more affordable and make it more accessible to more and more patients. I know we've talked a lot about examples today of existing market items like EpiPens and insulin, but I'm just curious if that is something that the council might take into consideration in looking at some of those drugs.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, so is the question, will new, very expensive, innovative drugs have exceptions? Or what is the question?
Not
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Morrison, not necessarily exceptions, but whether that would be considered in the overall equation as they're looking at this issue.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, yeah, that's an excellent question, and many different factors will be taken into account, and there will be certainly medicines that would have a higher reimbursement threshold set, and the example that you give is probably an example of when that might happen. But there will be many different factors taken into consideration, and the pharmaceutical industry will have a seat on the advisory council table as well. So thank you for the question.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. If I may, thank you, Mr. Chair
and Representative Morrison. And I'll be upfront. The reason for me asking that question is that there's been an assertion made that we would somehow be stifling innovation on new products coming out onto the market by doing that. And I think that this system has been shown abroad to actually not, in fact, stifle innovation, and in fact has not impacted their ability to develop and bring to market new and life-changing drugs. So that's why I wanted to make that point. The other thing about this, and I know this has come out, is that there's been some discussion about do we want to have a path where we're interceding in markets. And I think the reality here is there's some things that we know are happening in our industry. I mean, particularly when we talk about things like EpiPens or insulin, that we see trends across the industry where there's a consolidation of a lot of companies into just a few suppliers. So under ordinary circumstances, we would say that let the competition dictate the market. But in this case, often there is very little competition, which means that it makes the ability for manufacturers to take a drug like insulin, who's had very little innovation for years, to push up prices or to buy up their competitors and force up prices unnecessarily. So I think this is a really incredibly good piece of legislation to look at those instances in which those prices are priced well out of the means of the ordinary general population, where they can have really significant benefits to those patients. And so I am really grateful for you bringing this forward, and I would like to applaud you in your efforts to take this into account. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Just so members in the public are aware, we do have this room beyond the 11:15 scheduled adjournment time, so I have a feeling it's possible this one might go a little beyond that. So, but if members could keep that and testifiers could keep that in mind too, just so we can try to get through the agenda here. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in recent years, I think it was around 2016, where the cost of medications, that component surpassed the cost of hospitalization. So it is the major driver of medical expenses. Frankly, one of the difficulties we have is the U.S. is the most expensive, requires the most amount of time to get through to have a medication released. So some other countries maybe have it years before us, and we don't have, I guess it's a highly regulated, highly constrained process. Part of the issues we see is we hear about these huge costs, but then we also hear that instead of spending thousands of dollars, you're getting it for $20 or $30 a month because you're in this program versus that program. That complexity, I think, is driven by things that cause cost shifting. And I would hate to have, in the pursuit of making things better, we make it better for some and worse for others. One of the testifiers said 13% could not find affordable options. There's two ways you read that. I read it that 87% of the people were able to find, and that's good. So, I'd like to find a way that we can help those 13% without cost shifting more burden onto the 87%, so maybe now a greater portion don't fall into the existing programs. What kind of effort is there to maintain, not interfere, but share program information more universally and have that acceptable? My wife has had MS for over a decade. Some of her medications, the sticker shock price is, $10,000 or more. However, they've got a program, and there is no copay. Whatever the insurance pays is covered. And I know there are a lot of things out there. Is this commission going to look at how do we cooperate with the entities to try and make it more of a level and easier affordability and have these extra programs for, again, the 13% or how many don't fit into existing programs?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, that's a great question, and it's enumerated in the bill that those factors will be taken into consideration by the commission. So I think it's a great point, and it's part of the comprehensive conversation that we need to have about how to manage the price of prescription drugs.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other thing is we say, all right, it's on a generic drug. It's much cheaper. My wife had a push med, and the non-active part of the medication and the generic, there were issues with. And she went back to, the name brand, and there wasn't. What expertise are we going to ensure that, when this commission is doing things, and there's a lot of good things about generic, but there might be to a certain portion of the population, it's not as effective.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your thoughtful question. Those players will all have a seat on the council table, and I think this presents a real opportunity to really dig into some of these questions to better uncover why drugs are being priced the way that they are and what are the most effective treatments for certain conditions. There's a whole host of hopefully very beneficial things that can come out of this.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you. Will this commission also look at other things that impact the total cost for the, because we're talking patients that have, severe medical conditions, and we did community paramedics so that maybe we could facilitate a more cost-effective delivery, ease for the patients. So under doctor's order, they can do push meds. Creative ways of helping the overall cost. And then I'd love if this commission would look at the effect that pharmacological genomics could have in preventing, you know, you've got options and there's different costs. You find the right med and the overall cost is a lot less, and you find the right dosage, and you avoid complications, because these meds usually have a fair population where there's adverse reactions or other issues. Is that at all going to be part of the whole scope, or are you just looking at cost?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam. Therapeutic alternatives is also enumerated in the bill, so that will be considered. And I would assume that, I know you have a particular interest in pharmaceutical genomics, and there's a real future there for all of us, hopefully, that would be a part of the conversation as well.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on the last part, somewhat recently, the president did an effort, basically, a right to choose. There's some of these are experimental or just past experimental. Are we going to have a possible effect of where we could constrict accessibility to Minnesota if we add some of these price controls? And, well, we'll just, you know, distribute to the other 50 state or 49 states.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I think it's unlikely that this would lead to restricting access, because first of all, the supply chains are so complicated that it would be difficult for that to happen, number one. Number two, I think that would create a market opportunity for a competitor, and I don't think that the pharmaceutical companies would forego an entire 5.6 million population state.
Thank you, Representative Morrison.
You had one more question there, and I've forgotten what it was.
It's okay. I'm being told it's all right. Don't worry about it. So I have two members on the list I'd like to move to vote in the next few minutes. So Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And back to Representative Tice's question relative to the commission itself, okay? On 3.6 and 3.7, it says demonstrated expertise in healthcare, economics, and finance. What is that? How would you go about determining what resume they need to have that?
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, that will be up to the appointers. But it seems clear. I think it would be difficult to enumerate. You must have a degree in this or X number of years experience in that. But it will be up to the governor and the minority and majority leads in the Senate and House to determine what that would look like. But I think probably most of us have a common understanding of what that would look like.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Morrison. I can just say from personal experience, I carried a bill related to the qualifications of the Hennepin County Library Director last year, and putting specific degree requirements in statute can cause unexpected complications down the road. So, Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that. But what we're looking at here is some really refined expertise, because when you go to 7.5 and 7.15, you're giving this commission the authority to ask for internal documents, and then in 7.15, you're giving the commission the authority to decide whether or not those documents qualify as a trade secret. Well, if you're going to put somebody on here that's never had any business experience, they might have healthcare experience, they might have economic experience, they might have some financial experience, but they may not have corporate experience. How are they going to determine what is a trade secret? What type of criteria are you going to apply to these people so that when they're making these important decisions that they have the expertise to do it? And that's why I'm going to that particular part. And I recognize there may be some times that we can leave that open, but I don't think we can here. So that's my question is, what is care economics and finance experience so that we have the proper expertise to be able to do this?
Representative Morrison, I know you sort of,
Mr.
Do you have
Chair,
any additional clarification?
Representative, I think that this is a bipartisan issue that is in all of our interests to make the drugs accessible to people, and they're only accessible if they're affordable. And presumably, the people appointing to this commission have that same goal. And they will be accountable to the public. They're elected officials. So if they put someone who shouldn't be on the commission, that there's sort of no incentive to do that, I think. And I think that you have to remain a little bit vague in the description per Chair Freiberg's comments. I don't know if that satisfies you.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it doesn't, because I'm looking at this thinking, okay, now we go to Section 8.1, where we start talking about the determination of whether or not they're affordable, getting into the internals of the company. And then farther, when you get into 9.25, you're saying that this commission shall establish maximum reimbursement rates, which when you go to line 10.2 says the maximum reimbursement level shall apply to all public and private purchases, payments, and payer reimbursements. Well, my concern is that, yeah, that may be setting the reimbursement rate, but basically you're setting the price because you're covering everything. So where that's my question. I probably am not going to get an answer, but I think as this thing moves on, you have to look at what qualifications, because you're not looking at just healthcare economics. You're looking at somebody that can really delve into the financials. And if you're going to leave this open, that yes, maybe the public can come back on it sooner or later, the damage may have already been done when you have disclosed trade secrets of some company that now can't recover from it. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't go any further. I know you're in a hurry.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. Representative Lehman.
And Mr. Chair, you'll be happy to know I got my question answered by staff.
Thank you, Representative. I don't see any additional members on the list. Representative Morrison, any closing remarks?
I would just say that we have a crisis of the cost of prescription drugs in our state and our country, and we have been unable to get our hands around this, and this is a tool that our state can use so that medicines are accessible and affordable to our people. Okay. I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3228, as amended, be moved to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. I think Representative Purcell, I saw him. Okay. I think we'll have you go next, just so you're... I think this might be a little faster, but those are probably famous last words, but we'll see how it goes. So we have before us House File 3268. What's that? Sherry? I referred to the bill. Okay, so we have before us, sorry about that, House File 3268. Looks like this is going to be going to the Environment Finance Committee. So I will move House File 3268 to the Environment Finance Committee. Please present your bill, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg and committee members. House File 3268 is a task force bill, and it to deal with, augment what MPCA is endeavoring to do with these perfluoral, polyfluoral alkylated substances, commonly known as PFAS or PFOS, and there's a number of them. And as I testified in previous committees, this has come to me, and I am a chemist, and but this is really kind of strange. And that now we're finding out just how potentially devastating these chemicals may be, and I go back and I testified previously. This reminds me of 40 years ago, 50 years ago, 40 years ago when we were dealing with Agent Orange and dioxin, particularly the bad news chemical in Agent Orange from Vietnam. And I am a Vietnam vet. And I remember being kind of upset. I lost some buddies, Agent Orange. So, but I look at this very similarly. We've got this in front of us, and the toxicity of these chemicals is coming to light. We know some certainly about this, and I have with me today to testify Dr. David Walinga, who's a senior health officer with Natural Resources Defense Council, and I'd like to just say a couple more words and then ask Dr. Walinga to elaborate a little bit more on the potential problems with these PFAS and PFOS chemicals. But our task force, and it's laid out in the bill, I'm not going to bore you to tears and go through all of it, but you can see in lines 1.10 and on down, goes out 1.20, and then over on line 2.1. You can see we're trying to be comprehensive here with this task force because there's a lot of folks affected, and I'd be remiss if I didn't also mention that I've got sons that are firefighters, and our firefighters are exposed to these chemicals routinely, and they've known about it now for a few years, so they at least can protect themselves a little better. So we're going to set up a task force. There's a small fiscal note, $150,000, that is to assist, help Minnesota Pollution Control Agency in their ongoing efforts to define the pathways, the sources, pathways, and exposure routes for human beings. And we don't know all that yet. I was just reading an article last couple of days about the atmospheric deposition, so coming in rain and dust and snow of these chemicals, and that kind of alarmed me, and that even made me think even more about Agent Orange, because we get Agent Orange in every rain event that comes to us too. So I'm going to leave it there for my explanation of the bill, and I'll endeavor to do better if we need more. Can I introduce Dr. David Walinga to talk about some of the toxicity issues, please?
Sure, that'd be fine. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape, and be helpful if you could keep your testimony to two or three minutes. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm David Walling. I'm a physician trained at the university here based in St. Paul. I work for the Natural Resources Defense Council. We have a pretty large team of scientists, physicians, attorneys, and others working on these PFAS contamination issues across the country. Especially including in California, New York, and Michigan. I just want to offer a few comments in the slides that I handed out to you, kind of framed around goals 5A and 5B in the legislation that Representative Purcell's put before you. In terms of, like, these are dangerous, this class of chemicals, man-made chemicals, poses a danger to Minnesotans, and there are several reasons why. One, they're incredibly widely used. You probably know that. There are health risks across a whole variety of different endpoints, so different kinds of risks at even very low levels of exposure. We know that from the science that we already have, and it keeps getting stronger. And then finally, I'm not going to talk a lot about this, but these 5,000 or so chemicals in the same class are chemically very similar, so it's likely that the effects are additive, not just one by one, which makes it so important to have a means for coordinating a comprehensive response for our state. So these are everywhere chemicals. You know, they're in our food supply, they're in our drinking water, they're in cookware, they're in carpets and rugs. They're in personal care products and clothing. They're everywhere. And because they're in so many different products, our exposure is on a continuous basis. So I like your analogy to Agent Orange. The difference is that those vets were exposed during their time of service, but not subsequently. We all are carrying these PFAS in our bloodstream and in our body tissues, but we're continuously exposed on an ongoing basis as well. So they're practically everywhere. They accumulate in tissue because of their chemical characteristics. So some of the highest levels are in women who are breastfeeding, and they pass the PFAS in their breast milk onto their children. They cross the placenta, so fetuses are very exposed. Now, they don't have the same protective mechanisms that adults do. So, of course, those little people are among the most vulnerable to the potential health effects of this class of chemicals. So what kind of effects? Well, the best associations, the best evidence points to links to certain kinds of cancer, cancer of the kidneys and testicles, for example, hormone dysfunction like infertility and thyroid disease, damages to the kidney and liver and their function, immune toxicity, meaning like there's some evidence that when you have a vaccine, you want to mount an immune response. That's how you develop immunity, right? Well, the higher exposure levels to PFAS are associated with a less effective immune response to vaccines, and then impaired development. And like many very persistent chemicals, like Agent Orange, like dioxins, like PFAS, 10 years ago, we thought the safe level exposure was way up here. Now it's, you know, 10 times, 20 times, 100 times less. So even though Minnesota just had two recent levels, new health-based levels last year set for PFAS and PFOA, other states are already setting levels lower than that, especially when they look at a total PFAS level for all 5,000 of these chemicals. So for NRDC's approach now is that they're basically, on a health basis, there is a zero level of safety. So, and I'll wrap up. Let me just say one more thing. We have three things that we're focused on in our work in states as a way forward, and this pertains to goal 5A of the legislation. We need to stop our production, use, and release of PFAS, and there's a variety of ways to do this legislatively and working at the consumer level. We need to clean up the existing contamination in our drinking water, and that involves comprehensive monitoring. Having this zero-based exposure level as a goal, but then also trying to have enforceable standards that approach that goal of zero. And then finally, try and look for safe ways to dispose of end-of-life materials containing PFAS. This is maybe the stickiest one because we don't really have good solutions for disposal right now. So we definitely need more coordination and a comprehensive approach to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 3268? Okay, seeing none, member discussion. Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to ask a question about the bill. I just wanted to take 1 second and thank Representative Purcell for his service and his sacrifice in Vietnam. Thank you, sir, and I'm sure I speak on behalf of our whole committee and the audience here as well. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Get you, Representative Heinrich.
Thank you both for your service.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other member discussion? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Purcell?
Just appreciate support for the bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3268 be moved to the Environment Finance Division. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Purcell. Representative Christensen, thank you for your patience. So we have House File 3202. I will recommend that House File 3202 be moved to the State Government Finance Division. It looks like there's an amendment also, an author's amendment. Would you like me to move the amendment, Representative Christensen?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Okay. I will move the DE1 amendment. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. The bill is in the shape you would like. Representative Christensen, please present your bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. I haven't spoken that much today yet.
And thank you to members for supporting, hopefully, HF 3202. My bill, as amended, what we want it to do is to exempt simple hairstyling, washing, dyeing, arranging, and styling hair, and makeup artistry from cosmetology licensing. And as I move forward here, I think you'll understand why it's a good idea. The bill addresses a problem that many special event hair and makeup artists face in Minnesota because of the way the Cosmetology Board interprets its rules exempting certain beauty services from cosmetology licensing. There are hundreds of special event hair and makeup artists in Minnesota. These are, it's mostly women-owned businesses, and of course the clientele is mostly women, so I think we need to, I support young entrepreneurs this way for sure, but these are the folks that go into church basements and just help brides and bridesmaids to look their best for the wedding. Artists provide bridal hair and makeup services to brides and wedding parties at wedding venues. They also provide hair and makeup services for commercials, film, theater, and other commercial productions. Bridal hair and makeup is usually their most profitable service. By rule, the Cosmetology Board exempts beauty services for fashion, film, media, photography, and retail makeup counters. So they are not governed by the board at all. They are all exempt. Special event hair and makeup artists who work in these areas do not need the cosmetology license. For years, bridal hair and makeup artists believed that they were legally providing their services under the Cosmetology Board's exemption for beauty services and photography. But the board has made it clear that bridal hair and makeup artists are not exempt and are required to comply with licensing requirements and to obtain a special event permit. These licensing requirements are burdensome, to say the least. Minnesota requires two licenses and a special event permit for them to work. To comply, many of the artists would have to stop working, close their businesses, spend between $10,000 and $20,000, to receive cosmetology training. Minnesota requires 1,550 hours of cosmetology training for simple hairstyling and makeup, or 600 hours for only makeup. Until this month, the board additionally required artists to spend 2,700 hours working in a cosmetology salon, which usually took on an additional 2 to 3 years for artists to complete. Finally, the state requires artists to obtain a special event permit and to register every wedding or event where they work at least 48 hours before the event. The cosmetology curriculum is geared toward providing haircuts, color, using chemicals, doing facials, waxing, and nails. Very little time is spent on services that special event hair and makeup artists actually practice. Right now, the constitutionality of the board's different treatment of artists who provide their services for weddings is also being challenged by a group of bridal hair and makeup artists in court. They are additionally challenging the board's application of the cosmetology licensing requirements to bridal hair and makeup artists. This bill will level the playing field for all artists in Minnesota who provide simple hairstyling and makeup. It exempts these services because artists are already safely providing these services in the state without the regulation. I ask for your support to help and protect these entrepreneurs and small businesses who make such an important contribution to our state. I know in Stillwater, we are a wedding venue. The town itself, we have many, many weddings, many businesses in our town that that will depend on this legislation. So I hope you consider, I'm not against regulation. I call it consumer protection, and I think we need that. But I think there's some overreach here, and I'd like you to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. I do have a number of people who have signed up to testify, so I may be a little more strict than I usually am with the time limit. If you could try to keep it to 2 or 3 minutes, if it gets to be 3 minutes or so, I might.
Okay, I think. Yeah, I think
people know.
The people that I've talked to, it's between a minute or two.
Okay,
so it should
great.
Be short.
Yeah. Sounds good. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of HF 3202. My name is Christina Zimmer. I am the owner of Christina Zimmer Beauty. I've been a small business owner for the last 4 years and have been doing makeup and hairstyling for the last 12 years. I would like to share how the current laws affect my business and my life, along with the lives of thousands of other artists. I've always known that makeup artistry and a career in beauty is what I wanted to do. I've never seen myself having a different career path. When someone introduced me to the world of freelance and special event makeup, I instantly fell in love and never looked back. I honed my craft over the last 12 years as a special event makeup artist and hairstylist, and now bridal and special event makeup, special event clients are 80% of my business. I specialize in special event hairstyling and makeup. I do not cut, color, chemically alter hair, wax, or apply chemicals to the skin. Bridal hair and makeup is my bread and butter. I spend 40 hours a week building my business. The majority of my clients who book with me are through word of mouth and referrals. I work hard to hold myself to the highest safety standards. I come prepared for every job. I have 60 plus five-star reviews. My reputation is something I'm incredibly proud of. I've done this unlicensed along with hundreds of others. The Cosmetology Board has decided that in order for special event hairstylists and makeup artists like myself to continue working, we'll need to go to cosmetology school and complete thousands of hours of training. We have always thought we were exempt from the license requirements because we provide services for photography, but the board wants us to become licensed cosmetologists or estheticians. I have done countless of photo shoots for fake brides using models that have been featured in blogs and magazines, which is completely legal for me to do. But somehow applying makeup to a bride on her wedding day in the same setting suddenly makes me a criminal. These real brides have been featured along the fake ones inside the same magazine publications. We also need to get a special event permit, which requires us to first become salon managers. I have never worked in a salon and would have to shut down my business in order and start over in order to get this training. I have worked day and night for the last 4 years to build my business into what it is today, all while raising my two small children. What I love about what I do is I have the ability to be a parent while still running a business. And I'm setting an example for my children who are 5 and 7, especially my daughter, that you can be a mother and a small business owner and succeed in both. Starting over would cause insurmountable financial strain for my family. And it's not something I can afford to do. I'm risking everything to stand before you today and give my testimony. I'm risking my career, my business, and how I financially provide for my family. If the law is not changed, I will have to shut down my business, and so will over 1,000 other women across the state. This is urgent and needs to be addressed now for our livelihoods, our families, and the very thing we love to do. My career as a makeup artist and hairstylist is a part of who I am, and if I couldn't continue to do my job and provide these services for my clients, I feel as though a piece of me would be missing. I love what I do, and I am so fortunate I get to say that. My hope is my testimony will help save my business and the businesses of countless women. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my story, and I ask you to support HF3202.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Zimmer. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. All right. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 3202. My name is Amy Reed, and I'm the owner of Amy Marie Artistry. I'm an LLC, a registered business with the state of Minnesota. I hold a federal ID number, and I carry the proper business insurance needed to run my business. I'm a freelance makeup artist, and I love to work. I love doing this for a living, and I love to make people feel good. This is what I do. I am blessed that this career supports myself and my three children. As they say, do what you love, and you'll never work a day in your life. That's me. Makeup was an unregulated service years ago when I attended Faces Etc. of Minnesota, a professional makeup school. I received an entire education dedicated to makeup. I completed my course and hit the ground running. Since, I've gone places and done things I could have never imagined. At the time, I'd spoken with different cosmetology schools inquiring about the makeup training. I received the same response that makeup was only a day or two out of the entire $20,000 program.
I knew it didn't make sense for me to learn to cut and color hair, wax, or do nails and pedicures. I never wanted to work in a salon. The consumer demand has kept me and thousands of others busy. While on-site bridal services have boomed, the BCE wants to stake their claim by finding and shutting down businesses like mine. They made an example of other successful artists to scare us into their cosmetology and aesthetics programs. This was done by reinterpreting their own laws to capitalize on our success by cherry-picking the bridal industry as their jurisdiction. Makeup artists have been serving brides in Minnesota for over 40 years. This is greed on their part, as they are not interested in any of the other makeup facets that I work in. I work for many Minnesota companies, such as Polaris, Medtronic, Snap Fitness, MyTalk 107, and several production and photography companies. I prepare CEOs for corporate internal videos, take care of talent for product videos, shoot commercials and billboards for advertisement, headshot days at attorney and accounting firms, work on feature films, senior pictures, runway shows, plus many more. Outside of Minnesota, I have worked for Ford, Honda, and the Super Bowl. Most recently, I was contracted by NBC to prep Joe Biden's hair and makeup for a live TV broadcast. The BCE does not require a license for any of these other services. They are all unregulated. I ask, why can I do the hair and makeup of the former Vice President of the United States of America, but I'm not able to put lipstick on the bride in the state of Minnesota? The BCE isn't interested in any of my corporate affairs or other clients outside of bridal. They are not interested in the Clinique counter at Nordstrom's or the Mary Kay lady outselling her product. They want a stake in the $70 billion wedding industry by putting the restrictive laws and regulations on hardworking people like me. I have built an extensive resume, and I did that because of me. I have been the one to keep my ongoing accounts with my outstanding craft. My reputation and business is successful without a piece of paper that costs $20,000, 4,250 hours logged in a salon, or required hours logged in a salon, on top of all the permit and licensing fees. Thousands of artists are being stripped of our wages, entrepreneurship, and rights. Last year, I worked on 29 weddings. Out of fear, I have removed my bridal work and pricing from my website and social media accounts. Please support House File 3202 to remove the gross overreach by the BCE. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Reed. Do we have additional testifiers? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to come and speak with you today about the bill HF 3202. My name is Debbie Carlson. I am the owner and founder of Faces Etc. of Minnesota, a media makeup school in Minneapolis. I have been a dedicated leader in the beauty industry for over 40 years. I have held every beauty license offered in the state of Minnesota, including cosmetology, manager's license, beauty school manager, salon owner, and instructor. After serving the beauty industry for 40 years, I am disheartened and beyond disappointed. The beauty industry has heavily influenced state law and regulations at the expense of women and small minorities. The rigid requirements to work and maintain a current license are daunting and expensive enough, and the fines imposed for noncompliance and mounting costs for continuing education creates a vicious money-grabbing cycle. In addition to my cosmetology career, I have also been privileged to be a freelance media makeup artist and platform educator for over 40 years. Suffice it to say, long before there was a special event permit in Minnesota, there were freelancers who were working every facet of the production, on or off-site, hired by photographers, event planners, brides, and special appearance for photography or other. I opened Faces Etc. of Minnesota, a licensed post-secondary career school under the Office of Higher Education. My objective was to offer a more affordable and greater makeup education to those pursuing makeup artistry as a career, including beauty school students who were disappointed with the lack of makeup education they received in beauty school. The latter is a concerning matter. Faces fills that void. Makeup is not considered a headliner in the beauty industry, like hair, skin, or nails, but taught as a supplemental service, more offered to even out where a shampoo or a rinse has disrupted the client's makeup. Makeup in beauty school is not taught in completion, nor as a legitimate career. My curriculum's focus is on media makeup, camera-ready hairstyling, and business training for both the licensed beauty professional and the freelance artist. Those trained in my school fall under the BCE's definition of Unregulated Services for Photography, Fashion, Film, and Media. In December 2018, the BCE released a flyer stating that beauty services for brides are not unregulated services. Furthermore, the BCE sent cease and desist letters and fined some artists who were out working without their required 1,550-hour cosmetology license, their 2,700-hour manager's license, and their SCP permit. These actions by the BCE has disrupted an entire flourishing bridal and makeup industry in Minnesota. As of 2018, nearly 40,000 licensed beauty professionals in the state of Minnesota. Shockingly, of that number, there are only 37 licensed professionals holding the SCP permit that the beauty industry requires for them to operate legally. In essence, 37 beauty professionals can legally work for the 10,000 plus bridal events occurring annually. It's self-evident that this leaves a vast gap in consumer choices. It is also self-evident that most artists in the state have been serving brides illegally for years or decades. That 2018 decision by this BCE has devastated not only my establishment as a business, as a Minnesota's only licensed makeup school, but it has shattered the careers of nearly 500 of my alumni, along with hundreds of other artists who have been doing bridal photography makeup for 10 plus years.
Yeah, if you could please wrap it up.
The impact on my licensed makeup school, something that I worked on as the grand finale of my career path, has been completely ravaged by the Board of Cosmetology. It has been catastrophic, not only on my dreams, but the dreams of many others who are sitting here today. Our enrollments plummeted as the news started to spread for fear of unsustainable work, retribution by the board, and the possibility that they would eventually be forced into beauty school programs and licensure by the BCE. These fears of financial burdens are not being able to work without a license created a drastic drop in my enrollments.
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up here.
Yes, and a crippling effect to the financial devastation of the school. The steady annual growth has experience has been halted, and it has been perpetuated by the BCE. My alumni have worked all over the country on many important people. I'll skip past that to get down here. The entrepreneurs that are gathered here today in this room share a common dream, and that is that the consumer herself created this need. The consumer wanted on-site special event hair and makeup versus going to the salon. Through social media, influencers, and celebrity culture, it has become both prestigious and popular to hire on-site makeup artists. There are many ways that they can get trained, from a school like myself, personal training, or YouTube videos. The vital point of this whole thing is that the artist's education, their brand, their careers were not designed, developed, or nurtured by the Board of Cosmetology.
I can feel your passion, but I think you're going to need to wrap it up here.
Okay, so I want to ask you for your support for that bill to exempt makeup special event hair and makeup artists under that bill 3202.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm a minute, I promise.
Sure, sounds good. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Committee. My name is Jessica Maykoza, and I am here today in support of Bill HF 3202. I've been a professional makeup artist for 14 years, and I'm the founder of War Paint International Beauty Agency. When I started my career, I found that I did not need a license in order to be a makeup artist. Additionally, upon researching both the cosmetology and the esthetician programs, I was disappointed to find the lack of education that I would receive in makeup artistry. With this information in mind, I decided not to go to beauty school and rather teach myself and take master classes to advance my craft. The BCE in 2018 changed their interpretation of what photography means when it comes to hair and makeup. They have cherry-picked weddings, one of the most photographed days of someone's life, and have said that weddings do not count as photography. Therefore, make it illegal for me to do my job unless I have a series of licenses. Mind you, all of these licenses do not equip you to do hair and makeup artistry for weddings. In 2013, my husband Sam and I founded War Paint International Beauty Agency with a vision to touch as many lives as possible, the lives of our clients and the lives of the contractors that we would hire. WPI is a beauty agency here in Minneapolis that contracts makeup artists and hairstylists. We've built our company with key core values such as safety, talent, and integrity. From the beginning, we have technically tested our contractors to ensure that the people we're hiring give the utmost care to our clients. We also criminally background check them to ensure the same. Safety is taken very seriously at my company. Since its inception, WPI has paid out almost seven figures in income. This income has helped my contractors save for their dream homes, their children's education, pay off debt, and has even sustained them through hardships. If Bill HF3202 doesn't pass, I will have to shut the doors of my company. It's going to have a crippling effect on the contractors that I love to pay. I get really excited when I run payroll, even when it's a lot. It would be devastating to lose what I've worked so hard to build. The BCE, we've been running our business successfully for years, and now the BCE is trying to rip away the biggest revenue generator that we have, which is wedding hair and makeup. The fact that I can provide a makeup and hair service to someone who will be in a wedding photo shoot, but not for a bride on her wedding day, is absurd, it's unjust, and clear evidence that the BCE is only after one thing, our money. Whether we provide a service for a photo shoot or a wedding day is the exact same service. In addition to all of this, local businesses like Minnesota Bride and Forever Bride are going to feel the negative effects of wedding beauty providers closing their doors because they expect and rely on the advertisers to advertise on their platform, as well as national providers like The Knot. The wedding industry is an ecosystem that reaches far beyond hair and makeup. If one part of that ecosystem ceases to exist, thousands will be affected. In closing, I would like to ask for your support of Bill HF3202 to exempt makeup artists and hairstylists from needing to be licensed. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to testify?
Okay, we stand for questions, I guess. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, sounds good.
And you can, it's a passionate group, so thank you for listening to their stories. It's an important story. Okay. So any questions?
Actually, there is one more person who would like to testify.
Okay.
So. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Jim Hurst. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Salon and Spa Professional Association, a trade group in existence since 1927. My remarks will be very brief in consideration of the time restraints that you have for the duration of your hearing today. Real briefly, Mr. Chairman and committee members, our association has deep concerns and reservations of the legislation before you. I wish to commend the author and the committee for adopting the DE1 amendment because that does preclude this deregulation from also extending into eyelash extension services. The purpose of our concern on this is because the state policy is anything pertaining to cosmetology is best served by licensing the practice for the health and safety of the people in the state of Minnesota. And that goes back to 1927. The original statute was adopted 3 years after our existence, and it specifically included cosmetic preparations used in beautifying the face. Over the years, of course, the statute has changed and modified. And when I mentioned the issue with eyelash extensions and thanking the author and the committee for removing that from this bill, I think the eyelash extension law serves as a good guide as to how we should approach makeup artistry and simple hairstyling because the same problem occurred 4 years ago. Eyelash extension individuals came forward and said, it's not fair. We have to do either 1,550 hours or 600 hours of instruction just to do our individual type of service. We agreed with them, and we said, let's set up a specialty license. By the same token, this is appropriate to be applied in these cases as well. Again, the health and safety of the individual, of the consumer, should be concerned. I applaud all of the unlicensed individuals who are here, who have said that they do a very good job, and I don't doubt that one bit. However, if we completely deregulate this, there is going to be an uptick in the potential for diseases. And by that, I'm talking about things like pink eye, styes, if you have a dirty mascara stick that you use on the individual. If you're applying makeup, make sure that the brushes that you use are disinfected in between customers, unless there's single service usage. You need to have some knowledge of the skin and the composure, the complex of the skin pertaining to the type of cosmetics that you apply to these people. And again, instruction is helpful in this matter. What we did with eyelash extensions was we said, in lieu of the instruction that you need for cosmetology or aesthetics, take a 38, for starters, if you're already doing it, you can be grandfathered in. Take 8 hours of a refresher course, pass a basic test specific to this, and you're good to go. For new people coming into it, you can take a 38-hour training class, pass a test, and be licensed in that regard. By the same token, that serves as a good model for this going forward. Let me conclude, Mr. Chairman, by saying last spring, about this time, we were approached by a representative of the makeup artist. And when they shared this problem, we agreed with them that it's onerous to have to go through all this education if you just want to do this type of service. We suggested something along the lines of eyelash extension legislation. They agreed. We started working on such legislation over the interim. But as was commented earlier, since a lawsuit has been filed, and so we feel it's appropriate to not consider legislation in regards to this while the court is deciding this factor. By the same token, that should be applied in this case as well. However, as this bill moves forward, I strongly encourage the author and the proponents to take a look at this reasonable alternative to as an alternative to complete deregulation of these services. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks and certainly welcome any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hurst. Let me see if there's anyone else who would like to testify. Sure, if you could please come forward. I have another member on the list also. I can call him back if you have a question specific for Mr. Hurst. I just want to make sure everyone has an opportunity to testify who wants to. Please come forward.
Thank you, Chair.
Identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Nino Altabelli. I am Vice President of Rocco Altabelli Hair Salons. We have 6 salons and 150 employees. I am in favor of this bill, in favor of this this file at 3202. Just some of the things I wanted to talk about. I'm not here prepared, really, but one of the things was the eyelash extensions that we were talking about and how this affects my industry. I also work within a school right now, helping out a beauty school maintain licensure and work with them for their education and getting them salon ready in the industry. Right at this moment, we do have students that are being denied their licensure from the Cosmetology Association because they did not complete their lash extension quotas at the school and did not participate in the PST examinations that the state has provided as their test for these services. When I got started into this last year, I was working with the makeup people, and my father and myself, we travel around the world. We've been behind the scenes at all of these bridal events. But what's really kind of hurting me right now is 2 of the students that are currently just graduated, just spent $15,000, just spent 1,550 hours, just spent the $200 for their licensing fees. Now they're being told to go back to school and complete 5 lash extensions and take the whole PST test over, not just one segment, the whole thing, 14 different sections of the test. It is absolutely absurd. So I hope you support this bill. Thank you very much for hearing me.
Thank you. Appreciate your brevity there. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Welcome to the committee. You could please step forward. We are past our regular committee time, so I am going to be enforcing probably a 2-minute limit at this point. It's welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Melanie Rivers, and I'm a freelance artist. I've been an artist on my own business for about 8 years, and was not expected to speak today, so I'll make this very, very quick. A couple things that I wanted to clarify. It's not just women that are affected. There are a few men in the audience today that are artists as well. There are many male-run businesses that we work with, vendors that we work with, that are also affected, and not just specific artists, also other professionals in the industry. It's not just weddings. That's not just special events. Anything that involves like a gala, or if your sister hires me to do a makeup lesson for her at my studio, I'm technically working illegally. Because I love education, that's something that's very important to me, and that's something that has recently come to my attention, that technically I'm working illegally. If I do a wedding for free, I'm not illegally working. But if I choose to charge for that wedding, I'm now illegally working. So it's not just our ability to do it, it's whether or not we charge for those special events. And that's the thing, is if safety is concerned here for our consumers, then it should be concerned whether or not we are working for free or for media. It doesn't matter whether or not, because the services that we are providing are for this are the same. So if safety is of a concern, then that's something that should be regulated as well. And so it doesn't make sense to have that inconsistency across the board. Also, one more thing too that I wanted to, I'm totally drawing a blank right now. That this is something that doesn't really make sense to us, because a licensed professional also can disregard safety and sanitation concerns. I work with several licensed professionals who are not sanitary by any means and who pose several risks to consumers, and the rest of us have established businesses based on our reputation. So for our reputations, we do maintain safety concerns. So I think sometimes licensing can actually take away some of that responsibility that the artist feels that they have towards the consumer, because they think, oh, it's not a big deal, I work for a salon, they carry all the insurance. We carry our own insurance, and we do take responsibility for that. And again, having a license doesn't guarantee safety for consumers. So I just wanted to kind of add a few of those details. So thank you, I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Rivers. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we'll go to member discussion. Representative Mason, you were first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. One is, on the amendment, that section 5, now it says that that person performs personal services for the cosmetic care of the skin, but it doesn't include makeup services. So can you tell me the difference between cosmetic care and not using makeup?
I'd like to introduce, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I'd like to introduce Megan, who is here, and she can help answer the question.
Sure. Thanks. Please identify yourself and proceed with your response.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Megan Forbes. I'm from the Institute for Justice. The cosmetic care of skin is a very broad definition. The definition of cosmetology and aesthetics in Minnesota is incredibly broad. It can capture a lot of things, but Minnesota has carved out certain things that are safe that don't quite fall within this broad definition. An example would be hair braiding has been carved out from hairstyling. Same thing here with makeup. Makeup would be carved out from the cosmetic care of the skin.
Representative Mason?
That didn't exactly answer my question. What is the difference? What do you use for cosmetic care if it's not makeup?
Ms. Forbes.
Representative Mason, cosmetic care is, in cosmetology school, is more associated with facials, hair removal. It's more of the actual care of the skin. Not much time in cosmetology school is focused on makeup. It's more on actually caring for the skin.
Okay. Representative Mason?
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Representative West?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Okay, I don't know who can answer this question for me, but as a single guy, I really don't understand makeup or anything like that. But it sounds like people have been doing this unlicensed for a long time. Is there like a epidemic of people being harmed or people being maimed by makeup? Is there any statistics behind this?
Ms. Forbes, you look like you're ready to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nolan, we do not have any evidence of harm. Nothing has been brought to our attention up until this point, and you're exactly correct. Bridal hair and makeup artists and freelance hair and makeup artists have been working without licenses in the state for years and years, and this hasn't been an issue until just the last 2 years.
Representative West?
Sounds like a good bill.
Okay. Representative Mason?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I didn't know this brand of professionalism existed. Maybe I should, but I didn't. It still seems that you are using chemicals to do the job that you're doing. And I guess my guess is if I'm going to have somebody work on my skin at all, that they have some background on the materials that you're using. So you're saying all of this is being done. So if they're in the salon, they've gone through all of this stuff, but it's probably sounds like it's limited training. And then the group that you're representing now, they're using it, and then basically they don't have any training. They just kind of seem to be doing this on their own, except the one woman did have a school. Okay.
Ms. Forbes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mason, many of these artists are self-trained. Many have attended FACES, et cetera's media makeup school and have far more training than licensed cosmetologists in this area. There are various ways that people come to this point. And makeup is something that most women use every day. It's something that I think most of us recognize is pretty safe. But most of the people who have been doing this for years and years have been doing so through their own self-training and through attending or seeking out additional training by their own volition.
Representative Mason?
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no additional discussion, any closing remarks, Representative Christensen?
No, I'd just like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for listening to these passionate folks. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3202, as amended, be recommended to pass to the State Government Finance Division. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Aye. Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Christensen. And if anyone would like to stay around, we still have a bill dealing with the state register, and there is nothing more exciting than that. So I'm going to attempt to get through these. I think we can do it quickly, but I know people from the Department of Administration have been waiting patiently. So first, why don't we take the state register bill first? It's House File 3356. It looks like this is going to the State Government Finance Division. Would you like to move it, Vice Chair Salk? Okay, I'll move House File 3356 to the State Government Finance Division. Would you like to present the bill, Representative Salk?
I can. Did you say 356 or 57?
3356 is
56.
The one I have.
Okay. As was stated, these are mop-up bills. We oftentimes do these, and we got it stuffed toward the last 6 seconds of a day's business. So on this particular one, let's see. We have Aaron here to share any additional answers to questions and that sort of thing. I think the information you were given, which is the reduction of what this is for and why it came to be, is also possibly self-evident. So I'm going to just leave it at that. And if somebody has questions, we can expand this with questions. Otherwise, we can just approve it and move on.
Yeah.
So I'm going to leave it up to you to ask questions and call on members that would like to do it, rather than going through extensive explanations of apparently is a perfunctory activity.
The bill does update the way that the state register publishes items. I know you do have a testifier here. If there are any questions, members, do you have any questions for the testifier? Okay, I guess you're in luck here, Representative.
I think
South,
this particular area falls to the issue of we've modernized the world. We no longer use the stone and chisel as our method of recording things, and so now we have moved into other things, and the laws really do need to change to update to technology. Was that unfair?
That would be accurate.
I guess now you have to identify yourself for the record.
Good
now
morning.
That you've spoken.
Good morning. My name is Erin Campbell. I'm one of the assistant commissioners at the Department of Administration, and Representative Salk is correct. We're really modernizing. The other thing the bill does is change the date at which the capital events report is due. It extends that timeline by about a month and a half.
Yeah. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Now Representative Bonner is risking everyone's ire by asking a question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Salk, as an IT professional, I fully support this bill.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. With that, Representative Salk renews his motion that House File 3356, or I guess it was my motion, be referred to the State Government Finance Division. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. We also, and why don't you both just stay there, we also have House File 3357. I will move that House File 3357 be recommended to pass to the Jobs Committee. There's also an A2 amendment. Is this to put the bill in the shape you would like, Representative Salk? You
That's
are nodding.
Correct.
So I'll move the A2 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor of adopting the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Would you like to briefly describe the bill or turn it over to your testifier to do so?
I think we will approach it the same way for expedience, unless somebody has questions, and if you want to add any specific comments that you think would be useful.
Please identify yourself one more time. And.
Sure. My name is Erin Campbell. I'm one of the assistant commissioners at the Department of Administration. This bill is a more general cleanup bill. It includes a number of different sort of unique provisions. It updates a list of buildings under admin's custodial control. It clarifies that a retired state canine can be turned over to its handler. It moves the Office of Collaboration and Dispute Resolution to admin. That was done over the summer with a reorg, using admin's reorg authority. Removes some obsolete references to things that admin doesn't do any longer, like materials transfer and recycling services. Adds a definition of what a passenger motor vehicle is that really helps differentiate how admin's fleet is different than some of the state other state agency fleets. Indicates that the Department of Corrections is one, their institution community work crew do not have to identify their vehicles as state of Minnesota vehicles. Cleans up some additional Office of School Trust Land language that was just missed last year related to some special funds. And it changes the definition, or changes the, it has a instruction to the revisor to replace the word central motor pool with enterprise fleet, to just update the language with how we currently refer to it.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Campbell. Are there any member questions? Okay, seeing, is there anyone who would like to testify on the bill? I think I forgot to ask that on the last bill. Or the last bill, I'll give you a chance to do that if you want. Okay, seeing nobody, Representative Salk renews his motion. I'll renew my motion that House File 3357 as amended be moved to the Jobs Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
We made it through our agenda, and with that, we will adjourn.